794, Sorgel, June 8, 2008, lecture 2.3, the user system interface continued, and moving on to 2.4, display design. And before I forget, before the break, would you give me the description of your project, if you haven't already done so, so that after the break I can return them to you?
Did you get them?
Yeah, I got three. And I'll just put it on a moment ago. Okay. An important concept in human computer interfaces is the idea of metaphor or models. The idea of a metaphor is that you transfer knowledge from one sphere of activity to another. So there's a desktop metaphor for working with the computer. And the idea is you have piles of things on your desktop, and so you sort of replicate that piles of things, so different windows open for different tasks. There is another metaphor for finding things, the file cabinet metaphor. Organize things in folders and hierarchy of folders. Metaphors are both good and bad. What's good about metaphors?
It helps people who aren't familiar with computers start to understand way things are organized. If you say, it's like a filing cabinet. If you open up this, cushion here is like opening the top drawer and it has these files in it. It can help people.
So it's good in that it lets people reuse knowledge that they acquire someplace in another place. What's bad with metaphors?
Being completely, it's a physical object, a file cabinet, but it's not necessarily when it's on the web, online, it kind of dictates what users think of it and it constrains what's actually possible in the software.
So the file cabinet metaphor is actually a bad metaphor. Because, for exactly the reason that it restricts people's thinking. Paper in file cabinet is a very limited mechanism to organize and access information. On a computer, there's so many new and different things that actually having that metaphor in one's mind constrains what one can do. It may in one sense help them to do something when they otherwise couldn't do anything, but in the long run it will prevent them from really taking full advantage. And actually that means the folder organization is not the best organization, if you think about it. Files should have names, they should have maybe assigned some tags, but they should have assigned multiple tags. Which for some purposes you may want to operate like folders. So it's just one example. I have a bookmark manager where there are no folders for bookmarks. You can just assign them tags. And the nice thing about this, it will find some tags automatically from the title of the URL in some other places. And so you just have to, the obvious ones are really there, you just have to add some things. So one kind of tag I have is by course, or even by course and lecture number. Now I will admit it would be nice to be able to use the course and course lecture number tags and look at them as if they were folders, so that I could, for example, publish a list of URLs for a course organized by lecture. That's not easy to do. I would have to, I can publish a file with all the URLs that I did in a search. So I could do a search for this, and I could then, but then I would have 15 different files that I would have to put them together. It would be so much easier if they just, but they, actually, it's called PowerMart, and they don't, and the last thing they did on it was a version that would work with Firefox. Doesn't work with the newest version of Netscape, so I had to abandon Netscape and go to Firefox. It's one example of how things work together. How you select a browser. So one of my criteria for selecting a browser is it has to work with PowerMox. Because I like that. By the way, another nice thing about PowerMox is it has a search box. And as you type characters, it narrows the selection. If I type in concept, C-O-N-C, it will display all the bookmarks that have some tag that starts with C-O-N-C. It's very nicely, I mean, except for this missing, so in other words, folders as a basic way of organization is not a good idea because it's too limiting. Tags is a good idea. Now, being able to look at some subset of tags as if it was a folder hierarchy and deal with it like that would be nice. So I have a folder view. But I could do a different folder view on the same. I could go into some other, if I have some other hierarchy of tags, I could use those for a folder view. That would be good.
Delicious has a bookmark plugin for Firefox where you can kind of do something like
okay.
That.
Okay. Yeah. So the desktop metaphor, on the other hand, I think is probably pretty good because it's just, I mean, piles of things you use for different purposes. You have different windows and tasks open where you do things that make sense. So the trick is to have metaphors when it is useful to reuse knowledge. But not if they will restrict the thinking. And sometimes because they do a little bit of both, and so it's tricky to know how good they are. So though there's these different examples of tasks, metaphors, so one clearly is, I mean, you don't know anything but Visivik, but you see what you get. When I did my 1985 textbook on a computer, an old terminal, it was a command line interface. So if I wanted to change a word, I had to do a change command, change this word to that. And so clearly, if you want to do work browsing, you want to have Visivik. But in HTML, there are some HTML editors that do, and some that do not. And some people actually prefer the raw HTML because they never know what the Visivik thing does.
Especially when you're copying and pasting from Word.
Right. Or another example, we looked at the text editor operate on lines or on sentences or paragraphs. And the task object here clearly is sentences and words and sentences and paragraphs. Those are the units of text, not lines. But I have a problem right now because I wrote a chapter on digital libraries for a book and they want the version in LaTeX, which I don't know. And it's actually, I have to check is the real sort of hardcore LaTeX user, they will put in all the formatting codes. It's like if you were to do all the bold, actually it's sort of like HTML, but only there's a little more to it. And then you have maybe software on your machine that will interpret this and then show it to you as to what it actually looks like. And I don't know whether a Visivik LaTeX editor exists. But you do the formatting and then it produces the LaTeX. See, in Word, you don't even know where the codes are, what they are. Which is also bad. And you're perfect.
Can turn on, or somewhat.
Some you can turn on. But then it messes up your painting. Yes, I believe you turn them on, they will count a space for doing the page limits. So in book proof, I can look at the, I have it both ways. I can, if it's specific, and I, on the bottom, I can look at the codes and where they are, and I can manipulate them if I want to. But in any event, that's sort of the task metaphor for text. There are some other examples of task metaphors. An electronic spreadsheet. The spreadsheet was actually not invented for computers. Accountants had paper spreadsheets. They had big pieces of paper with cells. They had formulas, and they would all do it manually. Now, that was a way of organizing things that was perfectly suited, actually much better suited to the computer than to do manually. So, of course, accountants loved it once they had spreadsheets on the computer. So, as I mentioned, that the one for the Apple, one of the, I think it was the first spreadsheet device. One of the first, anyway, the first widely used VisiCalc. Good name, by the way. It sold a lot of computers because people wanted to use that program. A catalog in data input form. That's sort of what a catalog is used to. If you were to organize it sort of like visually, like a cataloging card, there may even be more use to it. Not anymore, because that trade has passed to do that. People are now used to input templates. But I think if at the beginning they had done it, it may not have been easier. I mean, the basic problem of the bad metaphor is that the designer doesn't think through the possibilities of a new medium. And so in design, the important thing is to sort of forget about what you know. Let's see, now that you can do it this way, how can we accomplish this task best in the computer? And it may turn out to be similar, but it may turn out to be radically different. That I'll be completely different. Many applications for computers, and catalog as an example, were sort of designed to do on the computer what you have done manually. Many digital libraries do that. They are just basically repositories of print documents, and most people will use them by finding a document and printing it. And not taking advantage of all the navigation you could do, the annotation, the collaboration of the people, that you could apply tools to the text. All of those, I mean, like more sophisticated spell checking than Word does, or automatic indexing. There are lots of things you can do. Translation, if you get the text in Spanish, you can read Spanish, you can translate it. There are just a lot more, how you can organize the documents. You can organize them in many different ways. You can have these multimedia documents and components. You can search not just on whole document, you can search on a paragraph that contains two words. You could do question answering based on the text, since you have a text in digital library. So a digital library, just as a place where I get documents, like I used to get from a shelf in the library, is just not taking advantage of the new medium. And early OPACs were just called catalog from computers. It doesn't make sense. So in design, you need to, that's sort of a, beyond software innovation, that's a general piece. And actually, I'm going to tell you the story from my university. When the whole process of registration for courses was quite different. Each student had a book where all the courses were listed, and so you would write a page in this book for the semester, and then you would have to go to a counter where they would read it and stamp it. And maybe, I guess when I was there, it didn't really cost anything, or maybe it did. So time it cost something they would compute how much he was out. But the university had no records of what courses you had taken. Your record was your own book, plus for some courses, if you had completed them successfully, they would give you a piece of paper. Like if there was, some were just lectures and you went there and you listened and it was the end of it. And some they had exercises or exams, and when you filled the requirement, they would give you a piece of paper. And if you wanted to apply for your degree, you would have to get a piece of paper. But anyway, the point was you had to go to this counter, and you stood there, of course, an hour and a half, and the counter was open from 8 to 12 in the morning and from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. And so finally somebody goes smaller and said, this is stupid. Why don't we just let the people deposit their books with a pre-addressed stamped envelope in a mailbox, and we'll pick it up, the books from the medical station, and we'll stamp them and we'll send them back. So they wrote the new instructions for the new system, and they said, right, so and you fill it out yourself, you have a double-addressed stamped envelope, and you can deposit those envelopes in the mailbox from 8 to 12 and from 2 to 4. The mailbox being in the open hall. So transferring old what practices from old technology to new technology. It's not good. And it's actually, it applies to this, to the evaluation, because you want to look at software from the point of view, does it take advantage of computer possibilities, or does it just implement old practices, old metaphors in the new environment?
My undergraduate college was in that in between. They had a computerized system for classes, but students couldn't interact with it. So you still had to fill out the form and go stand in line, and somebody would check off your requirements at one desk and then send you over to another desk where somebody would sit down and enter it all into the computer and see if you had permission to be in there, and there were people. And it's like, if it's already computerized, is it really so much of a bigger step to just allow student access? You know, even if they didn't have the passwords and the setups like now, like, can't you just install a bank of laptops one day or, you know, on registration day and have students come in and sit down and type it in? You know, save hours and hours of time.
Okay.
Everybody? Yeah. Anything like that. Ours was all, it was a small campus, so it was all stand in line. If you really needed a class, you camped out the night before.
Okay, so there's some principles in data entry should be consistent. The fewer keystrokes you use, the better. So what would be a good technique to minimize keystrokes?
Abbreviations
would be one. Selecting from a list would be helpful, but maybe sometimes there's longer than just typing it in. Auto-completion.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, you have that in many places now. If you type a URL in your browser, it will... Like, I just typed you, and it'll pull up United Airlines. I know, actually, the first will pull up is UMAC, which is the computerized grading system, class list and grading system. The second one is United Airlines. So it's very... pre-filling passwords. Remembering passwords and pre-filling them, that's all minimal input actions. Minimal memory load on user. So actually those two go together in a way. I mean, I don't know about your email program. My email program auto-completes email addresses.
No.
So I don't need to remember the email address. Okay. I have an old telephone. I used to have three. The only one still works. Which stores telephone numbers under three characters, right? It's an alpha keyboard. And so I don't need to remember telephone numbers. I just need to remember whatever three characters I chose for the name of my brother. But usually I'm very good. If you do three characters for a word, it generally pays to omit vowels. Because the consonants and the word carry more information. The Arabs and the Hebrew also know that. They don't have vowels, they just have consonants. That's also minimum memory load on user and minimal input, right? Instead of typing a 7 or 10 digit phone number, I just type three levels. You take an also more easily remember. When forms are filled in and displayed like bibliographic data, it's a two-way system. Makes sense. Another piece that's not in here is it should be compatible with data collection forms. So sometimes you have the input data from data collection forms, and clearly the data collection form should be such that it is most convenient for the user in somewhat logical, and the data input screen should mimic the data collection form. And similar things should be grouped. I mean, there's other things we apply to apply the data entry. Data display, we are going to and you can look at this criteria, but we're going to talk about it in much more detail momentarily. The user should be able to control the data display. But when you have a, that's another sort of taking advantage of the medium. When you have a printed bibliography, then you have no choice but reading the format that the person who designed the print decided on. Which more often than not is the APA bibliographic style, which has been devised by a moron without any attention to what's actually important to users. But in an online display of a catalog data, you should be able to do some of your formatting. In Dialog, you can do that in a limited way. For each database, they have maybe 4 or 5 preset display formats. You can display it with the abstract or without the abstract. But it would really be nice to be able to select from some preset formats that were intelligently made, and if you are savvy enough, to store your own format. So you have my catalog for the university library here, and it will do it my way. And by the way, my way would be to list the authors and then do the title of the piece in bold. And then whatever other information there is. But the API style will not be the title of the journal article, it will be the title of the journal that's emphasized in italics or underlined. But when I scan the bibliography, it's the most important piece in scanning. The title of the journal. So you really need to look at the user requirements and then design the format accordingly. But if users could do it themselves, then they could at least get away from visibility. System messages, we have a separate lecture on, so we'll talk about that separately. I mentioned that you have to look at user characteristics. So those are physical user characteristics. What senses are available to a user? And then there are many ways which you have to adapt the interface. And You either have one interface that is useful for all users, which generally means it's not as useful for any as it could be, or you have options. And the some of the options, there may be a computer algorithm, a program, that could take an interface and optimize it for colorblind users. See, I mean, there's generally sort of a dictum, don't use these colors because they're colorblind people. But that will take away a very useful way of conveying information easily for 93% of the population, because 7% cannot use it. So the smarter way to do it is to have a separate screen. Say if you're colorblind, just like you have on a website, French, English, Spanish, you have a button for colorblind. And you press that. Or I don't. How do they do it for blind people? I mean, do you have a program that reads any website and makes it usable for you, or do you have some?
I use a screen reader called JAWS. JAWS is Job Access with Speech. It's depending on the page, I can hear what's on it, but some pages also have a text version only button you can push and can select. So it takes away a lot of the icons and the because there are some things that I can't even tell that are there. So it puts it in the text for me.
So that's viable, but it would be even better if you had a site that was designed for blind people. Because that you could use that better than something that the screen reader produces.
I don't know. The only thing that I have seen work on are certain things that certain items that will help pages more so that they're easily read with the screen. Like I said, if it has a lot of icons on it, I can't tell with those icons. What you often do is put alt tags with them. And if you have alt tags on them, that tells me what they are.
Right. And then it could even, if it has five major choices, it could just on calling out the web page, speak out those choices.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So there are things one can do with a screen reader which will make the web page somewhat accessible. Mm-hmm. But designed from the ground up for a blind reader would be better. Sort of somewhere in between, you may have a basic version of the information, and then you have a program that maps it for a seeing person, that maps it for a colorblind person, that maps it for a blind person, and that a program has sort of design principles embodied in it to go from the. That would be something that, I mean, if you have to do every web page in 10 different ways, that might not be feasible.
No, it's not. It's too much programming, takes up too much space, and
yes.
Also the maintenance is horrendous.
Right, but if you have the basic information in stored in such a way that it has the information to be displayed, and sort of meta information, if you will, that gives the kind of thing it is, and based on that, it will be mapped to different versions of the website. That would be I don't know whether anybody does that, but that's certainly where the future will go, I think. You have to sort of customize the physical characteristics of the user. There's eye-hand coordination that you have to take into account. And there's something called, I think there's something called Phipps' Law for people to do. So when you, how big should you make a, how big should you make a button? And there's something that the farther away it is, I mean, the farther the average movement of this button, the bigger it should be, because you want to move faster. And when you move fast, it's harder to land in exactly one spot. And so you have to stop, and you have to, it takes you longer. So there's some sort of observation people have made about size of buttons and speed of being able to click on that button. But it will also depend on the abilities of the person. So a person doing a lot of video games is probably better at that because they have that ability. And somebody who's very poor in eye-hand coordination may be better to do some stuff with a keyboard. This personality characteristic, some people get very easily frustrated. I don't know how you consider an interface design, but it's certainly a factor. The cognitive characteristics of people, so time and attention, short-term memory, and people can only remember things for a certain time, only remember that many things. So one of the principles that follows from that, if at all possible, have all information that's needed in some task on the screen while that task is being done. Okay. So, if you send an email, have the email address of the person on the screen. Or if you have to switch to your address book to send an email, well, in that case, it would be very handy if you could click on the address book entry and it would start the email for you, which would either mean you need an indicated application that has address book and email both, and any email program has a rudimentary address book, not a complete one, or your address book application works with your email application so that it can open an email in your... So that would be one example. You have to have the information on the screen. Now, in terms of remembering, we chunk and the four characters, the four digit chunks was one. Try to remember this first string of characters. You won't have much luck. With the second? Done. Okay. So don't overload working memory. Now, long-term memory, The quality of long-term memory of a user determines what kind of interaction is best for that user. If a user can remember 140 shortcut keys, they can operate this program very quickly and they don't need any menus. But somebody who can't even remember one needs menus. Which is one of the reasons why one should have options. One size does not fit all. Okay. Spatial and visual ability. So navigating hypertext requires some spatial ability. Some spatial, meaning if you have a lot of visual, I mean, there is sort of a philosophy that visual display of information is best. Best for whom? It's good for the people who are visually oriented. It's not so good for people who are not. So in the display, not only in the interaction, but also in the display of information, there should be options. Some information maybe could be displayed by a graph or by a table, or it could be displayed by a text. And the text could be displayed for reading on the screen, or it could be displayed in quotes by being read. Or it could be displayed on a Braille machine. So there are many different ways of communicating the same piece of information, and it has to be adapted to the mode that's most effective for the user at hand, and users are different. I can't remember names anymore at all, but I certainly cannot remember them if I haven't seen them in writing. Whereas other people may be remembering them much more easily when they're spoken than when it's written. And I think there's some studies, and I'm not sure what the conclusion is, but they sort of have the hypothesis that if you learn something by hearing it, you can reproduce it more easily by saying it, and if you learn something by reading it, you can more easily write it down. I don't know whether it's true or not. And so it depends what the user knows. The semantic knowledge, let me start with that one, about programs, that would be knowing what the functions of the program are, what it can do. Syntactic knowledge would be to know how it does it. Computer knowledge, just general computer content, general experience. I mean, there's the one very simple thing you learn after a while. The first thing to try is to turn the device off and on again. That's a very simple heuristic for fixing computer problems. And that comes with computer knowledge. Another piece of computer knowledge, I mean, you over time just get precise. And some people don't understand for the life of them what's wrong, and they just had a comma in the wrong place or whatever. And using computers in a while, this becomes second nature, and that's part of computer knowledge. Or you can have some idea of how the program might work and why it made this mistake, if you happen to know, otherwise you don't. And then how much do you know about the task? If the user needs to do a task on a computer they don't know much about, then the program has to guide them through the task. So if you want to do an airline reservation, you have never done it, you may have trouble, and the program has to guide you. That's even true for getting a fare card on Metro. You know, I can never do it in San Francisco. And my son tells me that's because you know too much on how it should be done, and they don't do it that way. So the last piece, sort of going along with the or to be matched with the user-specific characteristics or the interface display characteristics. So the physical factors, legibility, visibility. That we'll talk about in display design, illumination, contrast, all of those we'll talk about there. Response time, we're not going to talk about there. There is some research that says if it's going too fast, the user feels pressured. So it's just the response time should just keep pace with the user. If it takes 2 seconds longer than you could handle, then every time it takes 2 seconds longer, it takes 2 seconds away from your life. And there's nothing you can do within 2 seconds. See, if you know it takes half an hour, you can go to lunch and come back and have it done. But if it takes 30 seconds, what do you do in 30 seconds? And you've lost your train of thought. So, so things should respond that if you do a Google search, it should come quickly. It's not always possible. If you do actually, even in Google, if the search gets sort of complex, it might take a while. And as I mentioned, in a database search, there may be very complex processing necessary to do your query. And in that case, it will may take 5 minutes. And of course, the worst thing about that is you don't really know whether the system cached or whether it just takes so long. So what should the program do to alleviate those kind of problems? Its response time is by necessity. So the first thing they do is get response time down. If that's not possible, what's the next thing the interface should do?
Show that it's working somehow.
I love those little bars that show you how. Yeah, the progress bars are great.
Yeah. Yes, but even the progress bar doesn't tell you how long it's going to take.
Sometimes they come up and say, you know, expected response time, but that's usually for things that take a long time.
The system knows about how long it will take. So if it shows the progress bar, the end of the progress bar should say 5 minutes. Because right now it only shows you what percent of the necessary time it has been done. Whether the necessary time is 3 seconds or 3 hours. So it should give you an idea how long it will take.
Sometimes it does.
Sometimes it says, but it should always tell you.
There's some things that it gives you time, it would also be nice if it, when it hits a stag that it needs to stop and go back, that somehow it would indicate that.
Yes.
Because I was doing a backup of my P drive the other day, and just everything was running really slow anyways, and so Nero had a little bar and it says 100% complete, and it's just sitting there. Now is it sitting there because it's frozen up because one of the servers went down, or is it sitting there because it's still working out the last couple of
days? Right. Yeah. My backup program tells me how long it will take.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it won't tell me how long it takes to count the files. So it takes 2 minutes to count all my files, and then it will and check which ones have changes in them. And then it will tell me how long it takes. Means of presentation we talk about separately, so everything that is here I think I will talk about. The only thing I think I'm not going to mention there is the example of calls for information coding, and those are I think intuitive calls. Red, something has gone wrong. Yellow, there's a warning. And green, it's good. Those are colors we're used to, right? And I know there's one program I have that shows up. I mean, it gives the message it's completed, and it gives it in this garish orange. And if you look for it, what's wrong now? It's fine. That message should be green. But people don't think about that. So I included here a reading, which is fairly old, but it's a good interface for a faster search, ahead of its time, and it's probably better than many faster searches now. So that's something to read. And we will now move on to lecture 2.4, display design.
This reading is.
It goes within.
Displays and
it's like interface design, generally.
User interface design
for. And it's just an example. How you could design an interface for a search system that's based on fast.
And our angle on all of this is to be looking for these features in the software that we're evaluating
yes.
to see if
yes.
they're doing it well.
Yes, yes. The interface is an important piece of the evaluation. So there is a whole collection of materials for that display design lecture, so I'm going to have a little more time. Page 45. The Gaulus of Heliopolis. You consider the task to be accomplished, the user characteristics, and we that we just talked about, the environment, this could be lighting conditions, this could be noisy, if you have voice operated. I mean, voice commands. And some programs do that. And the environment is noisy, there's some added difficulty with that. Now, very important, we just talked about that, but I'll talk about a little bit more here. Capabilities of this display device. Can you do color? What is the resolution? I mean, you, all of you know this with the problem that that the colors may depend on the user screen. And you do a web page design and you happen to have a 1240 by 2040 or something resolution, and you're surprised that most people find your website horrible. So it's actually this display device, hardware and software. Because web pages look different, different browsers. Slides, if you may look very beautiful on your screen, and you want to use one of these computer projectors, all your colors are off. So if you do slides and you want to give a presentation, optimally you know the make and model of the projector that will be in the room you give your presentation. So you can try out your slides with that same device. That's the only way you can be sure. I know I once gave a presentation and I had this nice red, it was a little dark, but I tried it out on my screen, it looked very nice and emphasized. People could hardly read it on this display. It's aggravating when you see it at that point. So display device. Well, this comes in very big these days with the handheld display devices.
Yeah. Yeah.
And PDAs, the formatting web page of information that's transmitted through the web, or other soft or screens for the interface for the operating system or word processor. In a way that fits on that tiny thing. And so that's the
frames, slides that come up with in frames on one of those little Blackberries. Sometimes the frame down the side, it doesn't show up, and that's where all the navigation comes
right.
From. Other parts of the site.
No, you have to design for the Blackberry. And so, when the system is halfway smart, it can recognize that on the other end of the line is a BlackBerry, and will select the display automatically. Which, by the way, reminds me, even for user adaptation, if the user allows cookies. And actually, I'm thinking about that. I don't think that exists, but would be really nice if you could have a profile on your machine that any it would be standardized. So any website you access could read your profile and then select. If you have on the other hand this method where you can create the web page from the underlying information according to the abilities of the user and the characteristics of the device, so the website could read the profile and then give you the page formulated, optimized for your profile. So if you're colorblind, you don't get red or green, you get the colorblind version. If you're blind, you get the version optimized for the blind. If you have on a BlackBerry, you get the version optimized for the BlackBerry. If you're a blind person using a BlackBerry, you will get the version optimized for a blind person operating the BlackBerry. Actually, on the BlackBerry, if you're blind, it may not be make all that much difference whether you have a BlackBerry or a full computer, because it's all audio anyway. There may be a bandwidth problem or some problem of what your software can do and so forth. But that would be ideal. So this would be considering all these things here. Graphics may do that. Do communication speed? That may be part of the. No, actually, it's also communication speed. Didn't put that here. You have to look at that too. The communication speed is slow. You shouldn't do a lot of graphics. The non-graphic version. Somebody came up with this acronym Common Cognitive Mass Interface Design. It's all sort of very obvious. If you read it, the principles here, it's quite obvious. Page 46 has some guidelines in addition to what else we will do. I already mentioned show information needed for the task. Show all information that's needed. Omit what's not needed at the time. Display the information used for grouping on the screen. If there's a sequencing, make that appropriate to the task. And maintain the context in a sequence. One of the ways that the GRUM is the, what they call the GRUM trail, when they, on the web, can do that. And you can do, and you could do similar things in any other software. That you have on the top the list of steps that you enter, so that you always know where you are. In a printed document, the equivalent would be a header. So in these lecture notes, when it's one of mine, the top of the page has the course and also the lecture number, the title. Do you know we're now in display design? Follow due context. In web pages, it may be a little hard to do. In browsers run on your computer, it's easier. If something changes, just change what's different. Don't rewrite the whole thing. That way the user knows what has changed. If you rewrite the whole screen with one item changed, now what's different? It's also faster. Just change the one piece. Okay. Has a spell check window pop up over the area where the wrong term is? So if that happens, the spell check window must move. Now, there's another principle that says have the window the same function all in the same place. So those two conflict. But I think the one don't obscure needed information is close. So if you need to move a window out of standard position in order to reveal information that is needed for the task at this moment, then move it. Because that's the next piece of message here, you're always in the same place. Unless it obscures. The next few pages just give some examples from Schneiderman that illustrate this idea of grouping. This is information about a person. Maybe you look at the first as the last, and then as ones in between. So, this Schneiderman's page 387, the first one. is information about a person in an employee database. And then on the next page on the bottom, in the back, it's the same information. But a world of difference in readability. And then there are different versions in between, each better than the previous one. Okay, so when you check out your software, look at how the information is displayed. And of course, in order to judge that, you need to have an idea what would be good. And this example shows you one. I'll give you more examples momentarily. Page 393 shows a very high density scheme, but it's actually okay. I mean, as long as it's readable, it's okay. The only one thing I might do on the page 393, see, the reason you want a high density screen is so people don't have to change screens. And you may need to be able to look at an entire table at once. So what could you do to make this still better?
You can use color to highlight
into
outside the normal range, so
like
that, so you use color.
That's one piece. That's sort of a refinement going beyond what's sort of obvious. These columns of numbers are not aligned. Not even around the decimal point.
Alignment?
Yeah. They are... maybe those the result column is the range column. Actually, yeah, they are. But they still look, I don't know, they still look somehow.
Because we're used to having them a lot, either front or back aligned.
It's also the type. The type doesn't
look
perfect.
The typeface is poor.
Yeah.
For this, yes. And why do they show one number as 4.78? That's actually what throws it off.
Mm-hmm.
If that was just 4.8, this would look a lot cleaner just from that. The
to the right in the normal range, they're not aligned.
Yep.
They're centered. Yeah, they're all centered.
Yes. The result in the normal range is not aligned. Mm-hmm. They should be.
Oh, that's
true. Whether it's really a good idea to have the unit centered, I don't know. The reason this is centered is most likely that the default in this program is centered. Microsoft table default is, and Excel also, to center. That's not true. Excel has centered vertically and left justified. In my Excel, it will always show the text in a multi. I mean, if some cells take multiple rows, multiple lines, the cell that takes only one line, the line is always in the bottom. Look at Excel.
Shaded every other line.
That would be useful.
Yeah, Excel does that, and then you don't lose.
Yes, Excel doesn't do the default. You have to do it.
You have to ask for it. But yeah, if you've got more than some number of rows, lines, it's kind of nice to have.
And how do I ask for it? It's not that simple. I mean, most people. I had a student. Actually, I have a little file of things that I sometimes use, and so I copied the other instructions. I found on the website how to make Excel do the lines. And I have the formula which I can just paste from my little file into the right place in Excel, and I can do it. But it sort of should do it as a default. Or it should have a button where you can request it or not. It shouldn't be somewhere deep in. But so the centering text in a column is rarely useful. Sometimes yes, but rarely it is. What is the default in world tables? The default is center the text horizontally.
Not anymore. It's left now.
It's left now? Is there finally right up to it?
Unless I manage to find some place to fix it.
Okay, I all right. Okay, then page 395 just takes, again, has a screen, how to do it and what, how not. And one principle here is clearly if you have groups of sentences that share common information, don't repeat the common information. Put the heading on top. Then just put the details. Some of these wouldn't need saying if so many people wouldn't violate simple common sense principles. And the others you can look at, I'm not going to enter them in more detail now. Some of you have done 670 with me, and that's what I'm going to do now is unfortunately repetition from that for about half and half, maybe. And this is just document design, or with more broadly called information design in general. And it applies to web pages. It applies to screens shown by any kind of software on your machine. It applies to slides. It applies to printed documents. It applies to any of these. Page 189, and this is actually, this is now 670 lecture notes paging. Okay. Just read through the principles here. By the way, a closely related field, if not the same field, is instructional design. And know the reader, which is actually, reader is here a term to mean anybody who consumes this information in some way. And the, know the student would be the application in instructional design. And part of that is need a task. So some of this sort of repeats and reinforces principles we discussed before. But in structure, when you do the formatting, it's to represent the internal conceptual structure externally. That's the important piece. And let me give you one example. Let me see whether I can conjure this image up in your mind enough. I could have I should have thought it if I thought of that example, putting that example before. Just finishing up a project here called CLIME, Computational Linguistics for Metadata Building. And the purpose of the project is to find text that's associated with images. And then from that text, extract subject descriptors for the images. Because subject indexing for images is notoriously impoverished. Not enough subject tags, because calories don't have time. So then one of the interfaces to show the results will show the image on top and the text underneath. And then it will show what terms from the text has been extracted. And it can show the text by persons, by places, by subject, their third category, types. Okay. And then the user can also highlight some of these. He can say, assign this one, don't assign this one. And so then, so you need two visualizations. You need to somehow identify the pieces that have been extracted as useful terms, or possibly useful terms, candidates, which the caliber of n can select from. And it might be useful to differentiate these by those types. And then you have to also indicate, once the caliber said, I want this one, you have to indicate which ones it chose. Okay. So one visualization of that showed like people in green and blazes in yellow and concepts underlined. Mm. And then it would show the ones the user has selected in red. Does it make sense?
Because underlined is, we think of as being a link to something that all.
Well, let's assume that it's okay to yeah, that basis, it's one problem. But the main problem is that color is used partially to identify type of term. Is it a person or a place? And partially to identify emphasis. Was it selected or not? It does not map the internal structure. The fact that human computer interface person can map this out. Which prompts me to say, don't ask the human computer interface people how to design this interface. They don't know. We just often do that, don't know. The point was, okay, we have two facets that we want to deal with. One is the type of term. Okay, let's use color for that. The other is emphasis. Let's use something else for that. Preferably not underlined, because underlined text is actually hard to read. And the choice of underline for identifying links was a very poor choice. I mean, you can't change it, because people now have other clues on which to do links. And so use color to identify the type of tool. Use bold to indicate those that have been selected.
And what you're doing is like that cognitive match.
Yep. Yep.
Using one visual thing to match one set of concepts and another
set
of concepts.
Right. Right. So it's important to really fully understand the underlying piece, the underlying structure, and then be consistent with displaying that. Okay. Actually, we should stop. And So page 190 is actually an important page. And I will talk about that when we reconvene at, now it's 11:50, so we'll reconvene at 12:35. End of this lecture.